This podcast is about correcting the balance, whether it's something celebrated as good when it shouldn't be, or the other way around. Or maybe the heroic tales of history just need to be knocked straight on their ass. Me? I just want to share the complete picture, because that's when this whole thing gets fun. Warning, jokes and sarcasm may ensue. Welcome to Prick the Balloon. Hi, I'm Mike Vance. This started out to be the first Prick the Balloon short. I was going to call it Prick the Balloon Short Episode 1. Catchy. Thing is, other people call a short like a minute or two long, and this was never going to be that. Still, it wouldn't be as long as a normal episode, so then I was thinking maybe a PTB medium, or probably more like a petite grown woman who still has to buy her shoes in the little girls' department. Well, as I started writing it, suddenly it was really not that short at all. So we're just going to go with Prick the Balloon Episode 16. But I swear, there will be shorts. Shorts coming soon, when I am unavailable for a little bit. This episode kind of has something to do with the women's department, actually, and it has everything to do with political and social correctness. And I'll start with some modern political correctness. I found at least two write-ups on this topic that called it the Eaton Affair, and one said that it was, quote, sometimes insultingly called the Petticoat Affair, end quote. Insulting to who? Modern feminists? At the time it happened, and for a century and a half afterwards, it was called the Petticoat Affair. And yes, it was meant to be insulting to Andrew Jackson and his cabinet, the people involved in this whole thing. It was a political scandal. No one set out to spare feelings, though, as you will hear, there were consequences. Way back in episode 1 about Andrew Jackson, I promised to break down this Petticoat Affair in detail. And here we are. It was one of the most blatant examples of raw political gamesmanship for purely personal reasons that we have in American history. And given the Orange Goons administration, that is saying something. Then again, Andrew Jackson was his favorite president. Now, I realize that old Andy came off looking pretty bad in PTB episode 1. But I would suggest that for a guy who abused his slaves and started a national genocide campaign against our native Indians and all, that might just be on Andy. I'm sleeping just fine, in other words. Yet, in this little short, not so short, episode 16, I find Jackson to be the sympathetic figure of the whole sorry story. Of course, when you're up against John C. Calhoun, the guy who, more than anyone, should get the blame for starting the Civil War, let's just say it's a low bar. A little reminder that Jackson, for all his careful work to hone this image of a rusticated backwoodsman, was in truth a very wealthy and successful lawyer who regularly represented large merchants trying to squeeze the last drop of blood from a lowly indebted stone. Sure, his voter base was filled with the ill-educated, and Jackson disliked the Eastern elites, but people who still paint Andrew Jackson as some sort of bumpkin rube are being intellectually dishonest and lazy. He was not bringing his dollar-off coupon to Cracker Barrel. Like several Washington outsiders elected to the presidency, Carter and Clinton come to mind, Jackson brought some of his homeboys to serve in his cabinet when he first took office in 1829. One of those was his Secretary of War, John Henry Eaton. He was another Tennessee lawyer. He had been a major in Jackson's Tennessee militia, and he eventually served as Jackson's personal military aide. Here is something amazing. The Tennessee legislature elected Eaton to the Senate, even though he wasn't old enough to serve, according to that whole Constitution thing we had going on. Eaton was just 28 years and 4 months old, but the Senate let him serve. They're probably thinking, Christ, we're going to have Ted Cruz someday, so who really cares? That makes Eaton the youngest U.S. senator in history. Eaton backed his bud Andy through things like invading Florida on his own accord and suspending habeas corpus in New Orleans. When Jackson got elected president in 1828, Eaton was the dude on the inside track to really good things. On top of all of it, John Eaton was not just powerful with a likelihood to keep climbing, he was still young and good-looking. He was only 39 when he took over as Secretary of War, and if you believe the paintings, there's this giant shock of black hair and a sort of Hugh Grant thing going on. Though whatever Eaton was doing with black women almost certainly did not involve cash or consent. Meanwhile, to back up a few years, there's this comely 16-year-old girl named Margaret O'Neill, who is the daughter of the owner of a Washington, D.C. boarding house and tavern, and everything describes her as attractive, outspoken, flirty, extreme emphasis on the flirty. And the thing is that her family's tavern is right near the White House, so these blutered politicians and military officers in fancy uniforms are popping in and out of there all hours of the day and night. The place is appropriately named Franklin House, because more than one twinkle-eyed old man is trying to play grab-ass with this teenage girl. As far as sheer beauty, maybe, maybe not. The only photos of Margaret were later in life, like way later in life. But my observation is, even in the paintings, she had thin lips. And personally, when it comes to ideal female facial features, I'm in camp full lips. Just saying. Anyway, though her name is Margaret, and she herself wrote that she preferred Margaret, history has nicknamed her Peggy. Her memoir even used the name Peggy in the title. So that's what we're going to go with. Peggy is definitely educated. She speaks French, she plays a decent piano, I think it was a Steinway. Most of all, though, she loves the attention of these half-drunk men, at least the ones her parents find respectable enough to let near her. Her own take from a later memoir was, quote, "While I was still in pantalettes and rolling hoops with other girls, I had the attention of men, young and old, enough to turn a girl's head," end quote. She had men physically fighting over her. According to that memoir, which is a bit of a suspect source, a guy proposed to her when she was 15, and when she turned him down, he went home and topped himself. She also said that she tried to elope at 16 and accidentally kicked over a flower pot on her way out the window, but her father heard her and stopped that shit in his tracks. When Peggy was 17, she married a 39-year-old naval officer named John Timberlake, who, yes, had been in a boy band early in life, but now he just had a serious-ass drinking problem. Allegedly, they became engaged on the first day they met. This is not what you would call a serious-minded, well-grounded young lady. Perhaps more of a "where's Britney's dad" kind of gal. And that's a joke. Don't get all panty-wadded. Free Britney, I know. Well, 2 years into the marriage, John Eaton, 28 at the time, and a rich, handsome widower, gets elected to the Senate, and he starts staying at Franklin House. He becomes friends with the couple, and he finds out that Timberlake has piled up a mountain of debts paying his own expenses while he's been serving in the U.S. Navy. So Eaton sees to it that the government pays off Timberlake's debts. Then he goes one better, and he wrangles a well-paying position aboard the Mediterranean fleet, which heads out to the, Mediterranean, which is over by Europe and Africa. Bye, bye, bye. All the while, young Senorita Peggy O'Neill Timberlake is stuck at home in D.C., where the horndog young senator just happens to be, too. The story going through the D.C. gossip circles was that John Timberlake knew full well that Eaton and Peggy were rocking each other's body, making the sexy back. But since Eaton had been so nice to him, he was slow to say something. After almost 10 years of these rumors, John Timberlake died at sea. You guessed it, the Wagon Capital Tongues, which was a name probably later used by an improv group, said he had committed suicide after learning that Peggy and Eaton had been doing the filthy. Not to throw a wrench into that whole conspiracy theory, but the Navy said John Timberlake died of pneumonia. But was it self-inflicted pneumonia? Da-da-da! Maybe he caught it from Vince Foster. Da-da-da! Eaton may have even been the one who told Peggy about Timberlake's death, but for the first 4 months immediately afterward, Eaton was allegedly out of town. Within just about 6 months after Cry Me a River's demise, Peggy and Eaton, still a young couple, mind you, were publicly an item, as in, boom, chicka, boom, boom. Rather than, and I never get tired of that, by the way, I'm sorry, never get tired of it. Rather than get any sympathy on the death of her husband, though, who had been gone most of their marriage, including the last 4 years straight, Peggy is now said to have a reputation that has been, quote, totally destroyed, end quote. Clearly, Eaton and Peggy have not waited anywhere near a respectable period of mourning. It's only been a few months. To take it further, some of these gossipy wenches are going so far as to say Peggy had been promiscuous, or even flat out say that she was a prostitute, because there is simply no difference between having an affair and strutting it in sequins and see-through hot pants down on the Sunset Strip. Here's where Andy Jackson comes into the whole thing, because he had just been elected president the same year, and he is fixing to make his good buddy John Eaton the Secretary of War. Now, all of a sudden, he's hearing these gossipy old cows carrying on about his buddy and the new girl, the young Widow Timberlake. Jackson himself is 62 years old at this point, but that is still not too old to have his head turned by a charming 30-year-old woman. Now, keep in mind that Andrew Jackson and his late wife Rachel had gone through a scandal of their own, because Rachel's divorce that they thought was final when they got married had not been, which forced them to get married again. And Jackson always blamed those evil-tongued gossip mongers for sending his beloved Rachel to an early grave. Maybe he was projecting here, but he was having none of this shit. Jackson had also stayed at Franklin House during the 1824 election campaign, so he knew Peggy Timberlake personally. He told his protege, John Eaton, that if he loved the woman, go ahead and marry her. And they did. On New Year's Day, 1829, just 2 months before Jackson was sworn in as the 7th president. The other cabinet wives promptly lost their shit. Collectively, individually, figuratively, and sadly, in the case of Mrs. Postmaster General, after a Sunday pot roast and... let's just move on. Leading the charge on all of this was Floreed Calhoun, the wife of John C. Calhoun, who was the incoming vice president of the United States. Floreed tells everyone who will listen that Peggy Eaton does not possess, quote, the moral standards of a cabinet wife, end quote. Now, let's pause here and visit that politically correct history on this affair one more time, shall we? One site called this petticoat affair, quote, a disagreement among elite women, end quote. Well, that's fucking absurd. And I'll play along for a second, though. Define elite. Yes, they ran in the highest social circles of Washington, D.C. But the old money society in places like Boston and Philadelphia, well, they thought Washington, D.C. was some fetid backwater hellhole filled with graspingly ambitious devils. And they were right about most of that. Floreed Calhoun might be hot shit in Charleston, and certainly had her own version of Mammy lacing up her corset before she was off to Twelve Oaks, but if she thought she'd be welcome into the parlors of Beacon Hill, she was out of her damn mind. So social eliteness is all relative. Now, if that site meant elite, as in women having any kind of power or control over their own bodies of destiny, well, that's just horseshit, isn't it? Women in 1830 were still 90 years away from being able to vote. Before World War I, again 90 years later, only the state of Nevada allowed women to serve on juries. In states established on English law, married women could not own property. Women in the workforce, well, that meant the enslaved, or those dirt-poor women who sweated their asses off for 12 or 14 hours a day in workhouses or big mills. A tiny, minuscule fraction of lower-middle-class women may have had jobs, but that likely meant that they took in sewing work, made and repaired dresses for women wealthy enough to pay for that service. Even retail clerks were still men. So for God's sake, let's portray the difficult plight of women as it was. The sad fact is there were no elite women, just the women that were married to elite men. But the PC history paper said, quote, and according to one local society woman, the ladies had, quote, within a quote, as much rivalship and party spirit, desire of precedence and authority, end inner quote, as male politicians had. These women upheld a strict code of femininity and sexual morality. They paid careful attention to the rules that governed personal interaction and official relationships, end all quotes. Well, hell yeah, they paid careful attention. That right there was the only way they could assert power, through controlling the social situation in their husbands' lives. I mean, if we ignore the occasional dollop of rat powder and a cup of tea, but shit, even Lizzie Borden was 50 years in the future. There's still more of this PC shit. Again, I quote, "Although women could not vote or hold office, they played an important role in politics as people who controlled influence. They helped hold official Washington together," end quote. What? They held only the role their husbands allowed them to hold. They did not control influence. The president's male secretary? Now that was a guy who controlled influence. Meanwhile, don't try to project modern desires for women's roles onto the early 1830s. You're being as dishonest about history as all those radical righties who want to tell you that the white guy is always the hero and that we never had systemic racism in the United States. On top of all of that, possibly the biggest issue these meddlesome biddies had with Peggy Eaton is that she openly talked politics with men. Women were just not supposed to do that. So in a way, a little bit of their trouble with Peggy was that Peggy actually did try to assert influence, however naive and childlike that might have been. Big sigh. Look, I learned a long time ago, never try to figure out other couples' relationships. We've all done the, why are those two together? What can she possibly see in that dweeb? And vice versa. Successful couples have their own little private dynamic. If it works, it works. So in 1830, some marriages were great partnerships. No doubt whatsoever, some of these wives talked politics with their husbands, but they did that in private. We have Abigail Adams' letters as an example. But we also have Mary Chestnut's diary to show us where a Southern woman's place was expected to be and how miserable it often made her. And Floride Calhoun and the rest of them were absolutely Southern women. Washington, D.C. was very much a Southern town in 1830. Floride Calhoun actively brought the cabinet wives together and organized an anti-Peggy coalition. They refused to show up at social events where Peggy was going to be. The Eatons were unwelcome in most Washington homes. Since a big part of Washington political talk takes place at these after-work parties where leaders get liquored up and dream up ideas like subsidies for IHOP, this whole shitstorm became a giant handicap to Jackson's administration. The people he is counting on to get things done are hating each other over Peggy Eaton. And make no mistake, if this happened today, the Pegster would be all over TMZ every 6 minutes. At first, old Andy Jackson blamed the attacks on the Eatons on Henry Clay, one of his big political rivals. But he quickly figures out that this is being orchestrated by Floride Calhoun. That bitch! But as much as he may hate Floride for endangering his young presidency at that point, he puts the real blame down to the ambition of her husband, Vice President Calhoun. And Jackson decided, quote, it was necessary to put him out of the cabinet and destroy him, end quote. It's going to take a few years, but bear with me. Being a widower himself, Jackson had no first lady. So Emily Donaldson, the wife of his favorite nephew, was the main White House hostess. Emily evidently visited with Peggy Eaton exactly once before that old battle-axe Floride lured her over to the dark side. That pissed off Andy Jackson so bad that he replaced Emily in her hostess duties, I said duty, with his daughter-in-law, Sarah York Jackson. That's right, girl, mess around and find out. Jackson had been publicly and privately defending the Eatons, and he finally brought this up at a cabinet meeting and told everyone to bring their wives in line and straighten up their own damn selves. Allegedly, Jackson at one point in one of these cabinet meetings was talking about Peggy Eaton and yelled, quote, she is as chaste as a virgin, end quote. Whoa, hold on there, Andy. The woman's on her second husband, for crying out loud. You may not have had the benefit of reading the memoir, but you're not that old, dude. You at least remember something about how it works, right? By this point in the story, you might be wondering how much of this whole thing has politics behind it. Well, the primary cabinet wives who were siding with Floride Calhoun were those of Samuel Ingham, who was the Treasury Secretary, and John Branch, who was the Navy Secretary. And sure enough, both of them are hardcore political and personal buddies of John C. Calhoun. a pro-Calhoun newspaper editor named Duff Green, who might have been the David Pecker of his day, had said right out that he thought Eaton was trying to force those two out of the cabinet. The big political issue of the day was tariffs, and one had passed in 1828, just before Jackson became president, that imposed a 38% tax on some imported goods and up to 45% on some imported raw materials. It limited competition for northern industries, which they loved, but the southerners' heads exploded, like when they got it in their skulls that Jeff Gordon had put a rainbow decal on the 24 car. The southerners were led in this hatred by Calhoun. Jackson, on the other hand, put up with the tariff for his entire first term, and John Eaton was actually in favor of it. So yeah, Eaton and the Calhoun faction were political enemies. At least two Jackson biographers flatly put the Petticoat Affair down to politics and the tariff of 1828. Eaton was, on the other hand, no innocent bystander being wronged here. In 1830, he saw to it that it came out that John C. Calhoun had been the guy who was pushing to punish Jackson for his Florida invasion way back during the Monroe administration. And that sent old Andy into a ketchup flinging tizzy. One guy, though, comes out from under these petticoats smelling like a rose. Martin Van Buren was Secretary of State during Jackson's first term. He was also the only unmarried member of the cabinet. His pretty wife, Hannah, had died before all this happened, so he could just sit back, sip a mojito, and play politics. He had backed the Eatons all along, which also got him removed from John and Floreed Calhoun's Christmas card list. After this whole petticoat shit had gone on for 2 years, Van Buren went to Jackson and he said, "Look, I'll just resign, and that way you can ask everyone else to resign." And Jackson went for it, and he cleaned everyone except the Postmaster General right out of his cabinet room. That meant no more Calhoun cronies on the cabinet at all. And not terribly long after that, Calhoun resigned as vice president and went back home to South Carolina, albeit very briefly. Eaton was also one of those who resigned, of course, and on the very day he turned in his letter, an article appeared in Duff Green's paper saying that it had been proved that the families of Ingham, Branch, and Attorney General John Berrien had refused to associate with John and Peggy Eaton. Well, rumors flying for 2 years is one thing, right? But when it appears in print, well, that's getting to mom and pop in the general store checkout line. Eaton fired off letters to those three guys, demanding to know which one of them is behind this dastardly leak. Ingham writes back with this snotty letter saying, "Wasn't me, but it's still true." He possibly also said, "Na na 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 na, I know you are, but what am I?" Recent Secretary of War Eaton then challenges recent Secretary of the Treasury Ingham to a duel. Two cabinet secretaries. Imagine for a minute Bill Barr going all nuclear throwdown on Madeleine Albright. Ingham is probably thinking, "Dude, Jackson killed more than one person in duels, and this is his protege, so maybe not." Ingham writes back, saying he holds Eaton in, quote, "pity and contempt," end quote, but will not accept the dueling challenge. Eaton calls Ingham a coward, whereupon Eaton and his brother-in-law stomp up and down the street outside Ingham's lodging house all night like meth-addled characters from West Side Story. When Andrew Jackson asked Eaton about that, Eaton admitted that he may have, quote, "passed by." When you're a jet, but Jackson appointed John Eaton governor of Florida Territory, which he owned at this time, I might add, and later appointed him minister to Spain. For Van Buren, Jackson appointed him minister to Great Britain, the biggest prize in American diplomacy. But Calhoun had not yet resigned at that moment, and his deciding vote sunk Van Buren's nomination. And Calhoun said he intended to, quote, "kill him, sir, kill him dead. He will never kick, sir, never kick," end quote. Notice how Calhoun sounds a lot like Foghorn Leghorn. Of course, we all know what happened on that front. Martin Van Buren became vice president for Jackson's second term and then got elected president in 1836. After all of this had blown over, Jackson was asked for his opinion on the petticoat affair, and he said, quote, "I would rather have live vermin on my back than the tongue of one of those Washington women on my reputation," end quote. Like I said, that's the part where I sympathize with Andrew Jackson. I would like to mention at this juncture that I have gone this far in a topic called the petticoat affair without mentioning Betty Jo, Bobby Jo, or Billy Jo. Though I must add that when Uncle Joe buttoned his vest to his pants, that was one of the funniest things in television history. Okay, John C. Calhoun is one of the most reprehensible villains in United States history. He deserves much more time, and he will get it eventually. But for now, let me point out this. Even while he was the man's vice president, Calhoun had been opposing a second term for Jackson, saying that he deserved the job himself. He had wanted to be president for a long damn time, and he had tried every snaky angle possible. But after this petticoat affair, Calhoun was toast as far as a national scale. So he went back to South Carolina and got himself elected to the Senate, and he changed from being a potential national leader to being a bitter, batshit crazy sectional leader. If any actor could have possibly done Calhoun justice on the big screen, it was Jack Elam. So let that form your mental picture. It was Calhoun, the Southern partisan, who somewhat started the radical right wing in the United States. He was consumed by the Tariff of 1828, which Southerners called the Tariff of Abominations, and it led him to fight for the premise of nullification, where a state can just nullify a federal law they don't like. Constitution be damned. It was Calhoun who became the main guy floating secession from the Union if the rest of the states didn't let the South have their wit away. It was Calhoun who became the leader of pushing for not just the protection of slavery, but its grand expansion. Like I said, much more on that butt stain some other day. But let's not forget Peggy Eaton in all of this. She got to go to Spain as wife of the U.S. minister, and that must have been fun. She and Eaton stayed married till he died, 25 years later. There was a memoir that she dictated when she was 75 years old, and it wasn't published until 1932, 50 years after she died. Most of it is high drama, claims of how she told off the various people who slandered her, and some of it is pretty transparent about Peggy in some spots. Here's part of what she said about Floride and her girls. Quote, "I was quite as independent as they and had more powerful friends. None of them had beauty, accomplishments, or graces in society of any kind, and for these reasons, they were jealous of me." End quote. Peggy called herself, quote, "foolish, hasty, but not vicious." End quote. She said all of her lovers, her word, I might have gone with wildly rutting bedhoppers, were, quote, "gentlemen and in good positions in society," end quote. Many of those positions can be found in the Hillbilly Kama Sutra. She flatly denied being loose when she was a teenager, and she got a little upset about this. Quote, "I do not think I was ever witty. I am very sure I have been pretty, and if I have been seen as impertinent to the world as the world has been to me, I should deserve the epithet saucy. But if he intended to apply the statement to me that I ever made free with the inmates of my father's house, or allowed them to make free with me, I stamp it as a calumny, and my life shows that a virtuous girl, the daughter of virtuous parents, cannot escape calumny at the hands of biographers who write sensational history." End quote. See, Peggy got a little upset. Peggy did include this passage at the end of her memoir, and based on other memoirs of entertaining women married to politicians, it still has legs. Quote, "Pity me, my friends. I was born and raised in Washington. God help the woman who must live in Washington." End quote. Bottom line, most of what she wrote also suggests that she loved every minute of the attention. Quote, "The men in the public house who were fit associates for us, my father would naturally introduce to his family, and in this way, from my earliest years, I became acquainted with all the distinguished men in the nation. I was always a pet. I suppose I must have been very vivacious. I think I have a little life still left." End quote. How about the end of the story? John Eaton died in 1856, and 3 years later, Peggy married an Italian music teacher and dancing master. Presumably because there was no such thing as a tennis pro or fitness coach at the time. Peggy was 59, and the guy was in his mid-20s, so either the old lady still had some game, or it was the money talking, right? Eaton had left her a tidy sum. Well, turns out it was both. She and Antonio were married 7 years, 5 of which, Peggy said, were blissful, before he took her fortune and booked it back to Italy. And oh yeah, he also took Peggy's 17-year-old granddaughter. If there's any karma to be found there, I'll let y'all figure that out individually. Please make sure you're signed up as a follower / subscriber / acolyte / apostle / devotee of this podcast, no matter where you get it. That way you'll know when these upcoming Prick the Balloon shorts, balloon shorts, drops, drop your shorts. I'll be back with full episodes starting in early to mid-June. And one other huge announcement. My newest book, a fun nonfiction title called Undertold Texas, is now out. It is a collection of 48 lesser-known stories from Texas history, and while it is devoid of cuss words, there are plenty of tales y'all will enjoy. You can find it at the Zahn or order it through your favorite bookstore. If it's not showing up on the bookstore computers, check back. It's a brand new title. After June 1st, you can order a signed copy through my website. Thanks for listening. Be sure to check out my website at mikevancewriter.com. Prick the Balloon is copyrighted by Mike Vance, all rights reserved.